Court of Southern Judicial Circuit. Hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Continental Insurance Company versus MV Arosa. Mr. Sweeney.
Good morning, Your Honor. In this case, the district court correctly found that the extension of suit time, which was granted by FedNav, was ambiguous in its wording, but it erred in refusing to apply the doctrine of contra proferentum to resolve that ambiguity. And that should have been resolved as against FedNav. That contra proferentum doctrine is not, as the district court incorrectly found, a last resort tiebreaker only to be used as a last means or a last measure. Rather, as this court said in Bork versus Dun and Bradstreet, which we cited in our papers, which applied Illinois law and which quoted the Supreme Court of Illinois, found any ambiguous terms of a contract must be resolved against the drafter of the disputed language.
Mr. Sweeney,
yes.
Assuming that term, complete claim supporting documents, is ambiguous. What is your argument for the notion that the documents the Continental submitted might satisfy at least one reasonable interpretation of the term?
Well, Your Honor, there were a number of documents. I think there were 50-some-odd pages of documents, all of which went to support the claim that was being presented under the bill of lading.
I mean, like, for example, could FedNav have determined from the documents that were submitted what the amount of Continental's claim was?
There was, as of that time, the complete documents as they existed as of that time gave the estimated amount of the claim.
Well, but wouldn't any reasonable interpretation of complete claims supporting documents include an amount certain, not a possible amount or a probable amount? Or
as of that time, Your Honor, there had been no final quantification. So that was the completeness as of the time that FedNav was demanding it.
I had some other questions about this also, except mine has really two branches of procedural questions. One on this issue of what constitutes complete documentation, how much you had. The district court handled this as a 12B1 motion. Why does this go to the subject matter jurisdiction of the court?
That was something that was raised by the other side. I don't know that, in fact, it does go to the subject matter jurisdiction here.
Well, it doesn't, actually. And that in turn, gives us another problem, because if it were a proper 12B1 motion, for example, if somebody had been contesting whether the amount in controversy was met, in a diversity case, the district court's entitled to resolve disputed facts. But if it's not a 12B1 motion, if it's something that should have been considered under 12B6 or 12C or Rule 56, the district judge, of course, does not resolve facts. And I'm concerned about whether there are factual issues here with respect to the amount of damage or what was in your documents or other kinds of factual issues that whose resolution would depend on how this motion was properly characterized.
Well, that's exactly what the court did go into below in determining what was ambiguous, what satisfied, what didn't satisfy the condition precedent that was built into that extension.
But you haven't argued here that the district court improperly resolved questions of fact, have you?
No, we have not.
And my other concern, which you can save, but I don't want you to forget to get to it, is even if you're right about all of this material about the documentation or about the extension, I have a hard time understanding why Burns Harbor is in Illinois. I understand what you're saying about the Chicago port, but in fact, I don't understand why you didn't file a protective action in the Northern District of Indiana, and I don't understand why the venue problem doesn't dispose of all three of these cases, regardless of what went on otherwise.
No, I plan to address that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Is it true that Continental had submitted satisfactory claims supporting documents on a different occasion?
Well, and this is all subjective in the eyes of FedNav. In other words, it's only FedNav that came back and invoked the time bar against Continental on the one hand, when on the other, they did not. It was unilateral choice unto FedNav, and here they invoked it. The other claim, which was much less in terms of dollars,
would you argue that on that other occasion, the documentation, the sort of documentation that was required was different in some way?
No, I think it was of a similar character, Your Honor, in terms of obviously
not a sum certain, etc.
In that one, the if I'm thinking of the one that FedNav alluded to, they did have, at that point, they did have a quantification. They did have a sum certain. The case that we're talking about now was a very, very large case, and it took quite a while to resolve itself. This was steel damage, and the steel end user takes quite a long time to work through the large inventory to determine what is that sum certain. If we're looking only at a $40,000 case, that goes a lot quicker. You get to the end number that much faster.
Didn't they allege, however, that you knew that amount within a week? You had a week after you learned that amount to file?
I don't believe it was a week. It wasn't long thereafter that the sum did become certain. That's true.
Was there evidence of industry practice? I know you have your regulation, but was there industry practice evidence about what's considered complete claims supporting documents in this case?
No, Your Honor, and the reason being is that this particular condition that was set up by FedNav is outside of industry practice.
But why would, I mean, it seems to me if you agreed to language that vague, FedNav has argued, why wasn't it up to you before the original limitations period expired to pick up the phone and call them and say, you know, please confirm that this is enough? You yourself are arguing that there might have been a certain amount of in the eye of the beholder about this, but I can see that looking at the sentence, that you agreed to it. You agreed to sort of leave it up to them.
Well, then we come to the prevention doctrine, Your Honor, and whose burden is that to pick up the phone to make that clarification?
Right.
We've argued this in the prevention doctrine that it's incumbent upon FedNav to do that.
Why is it their burden, though, if you're the one who wants the extra time? It's not that hard to file a lawsuit. No, you know, I can't believe that you would have had Rule 11 problems if there's damage to the cargo and you've gotten as far as these documents.
Your Honor, we were still, the maritime practice, the industry practice is to gain these extensions of suit time. As I said, when you have a large claim like this, it takes a long time to come to the end of it, to actually come to a sum certain.
I think what my sister is saying to you is, why isn't it fair to suppose that Continental had some duty of inquiry with respect to what it was that FedNav wanted in the way of supporting documentation?
Well, because the claims document had already been submitted at that point. There was nothing to, at that time, there was nothing to red light anything to Continental that they were somehow deficient. If FedNav considered them to be deficient, then it was up to FedNav to announce that to the claimant, in this case Continental.
Is it your argument that because of the prior claim, you were, you know, you felt comfortable? Is that your argument?
No, Your Honor. Actually, it was a subsequent claim that FedNav is talking about.
No, but the one that all went smoothly with.
That was a subsequent claim.
After all of this?
Yes, Your Honor. With the condition. This was a condition that they have just
set up once or twice. I misunderstood that, I have to tell you. I thought it was a prior claim.
Just coming to the point about the venue. The forum selection clause, which triggered this venue situation, we maintain had an extrinsic ambiguity, which is the clause reads fine. However, when you apply it in a real-world context, it becomes ambiguous. Here, again, it should be construed against FedNav. The reason being is that the real-world context, and we can look to the various entities, the executive order, which the district judge recognized.
Is it your position, forgive me, but is it mm-hmm. your position that even if the bill of lading specified Burns Harbor as a port of discharge, the carrier would have been free to drop it off, for example, in Waukegan or any other port that the Customs Service deems part of, you know, the Port of Chicago?
No, Your Honor. What we're saying is the forum selection clause can be read as certainly for Burns Harbor, and then when you look to where Burns Harbor is, where's the district court? Burns
it's
Harbor.
In Hammond.
But that falls within the Port of Chicago, which
well, but that's
is within
Port of Waukegan, as Judge Rovner correctly says. And isn't the purpose of the forum selection clause to select a forum, not two fora that may be equally available, which seems to be your argument?
Well, in this case, this is how it's to be read. When we put it in the real-world context of what is Burns Harbor in the commercial context, commercial reality, and where is it? And it's within the Port of Chicago. And there's numerous different entities, governmental and otherwise, commercial entities, that all define it being within the Port of Chicago, i.e. Northern District of Illinois.
Thank you. Mr. Snyder.
I take responsibility for the district court having found an ambiguity in the phrase complete claim supporting document.
You might want to use the microphone since it records for the...
I take responsibility for the district court's having found that there was an ambiguity, because after doing these cargo claims for 35 years, I assume that everybody knows what can clean complete claim supporting documents, and that was unfair to His Honor, and that's how it came about.
But are you saying, though, that there is an industry practice about what would constitute complete claims, and that there was evidence about this industry practice? Because I really have a beef with you folks about trying to do this under 12b-1, where the district judge is resolving disputed issues of fact that he has no business to resolve.
In Exhibit 10, in the record, this is the complete claim supporting document. It's not 54 pages. It's easily 500. And in this, there's a letter from J.A. Lorenzo and Company, who was the importer's customs broker. And he is forwarding the complete claims documentation. This is what the insurance broker for the plaintiff importer called this documentation when he's submitting it to the underwriter who's the plaintiff subrogated in this lawsuit. Says, hi Ken, this particular claim is in excess of our settling authority. Therefore, we refer the matter to you for payment.
What's the date of this letter?
Of this letter is April 22, 2002.
So it's just a couple of days before the end point of this 30 days that you wanted to...
That's correct.
Okay.
And he says, we append all the documents and our information made available to us by the assured in support of their claim. And that is complete claim supporting document. And the most important of these documents is the damage survey report done by a marine surveyor who itemizes each coil and the weight and the bill of lading and the sound market value and the scrap credit and the salvage credit and the net claim for each coil of steel. And this is critical information. If you want to see an ambiguity, I'll bring in a coil of steel, cold rolled sheet steel. I've taken the wrappers off. I've taken the bands off. I've taken the tags off. There's no way of knowing where this coil of steel came from, whether it was from our ship or another ship, how long it was been there. If you see some rust on it, you don't know where the rust began and how extensive it is until you unroll it. That's why marine surveyors with reputations for integrity are called upon to be there when the coils are unwrapped and to make all these records on which the industry relies.
But your point is that this can be done within the 30 days that FedNav gave.
Well, the survey report was completed by Inland Marine Surveys on April the 19th. And I have a calendar in front of me. I don't know whether 20 and 21 were Saturday and Sunday or not. So, I mean, I'm not going to...
Well, my recollection is some... I indicated five or a week, but it was within... It was 5 days or a week.
That's correct. And these documents, if they could have been sent by Lorenzo to the underwriter on April the 22nd, there's no reason in the world why they couldn't have been sent to FedNav the same day. And we wouldn't be here. But they weren't. They were not sent the next day, the day after that. They weren't sent till May 10th. Now, the plaintiffs make a statement in their brief that they sent everything that they had.
Well, let me back up, though, because granting that there is much more complete information in that book that you have there, if the plaintiffs had sent enough on the earlier date, then it wouldn't matter that now there was more information. It's frequently the case that people will fill in the blanks even if the outline of the story is perfectly clear. And if they had sent enough, then the fact that they send more later shouldn't really be held against them. Doesn't the question still get back to whether, first of all, whether this is a phrase that's capable of interpretation by a judge alone is a question of law in an essentially contractual arrangement. And if so, did these documents live up to the standard? It's kind of an application of law to fact already.
The things they sent us told us nothing about the particulars of the claim. They sent us bills of lading. We issued those bills of lading. We didn't need those bills of lading.
Yeah.
There are bills of lading. They sent us the packing list. If we issued the bills of lading, we're stopped from claiming that the goods described on the bills of lading.
Right.
And so the packing list is just superfluous.
Well, Judge Wood asked earlier if there was a custom within the industry, and you should hold up that packet of things. Is that the complete documentation that you expect in every case?
Yes, there's one document that is critical, and that is the damage survey done by the surveyors or adjusters to adjust the loss. That's the critical document. Don Lee testified on his deposition that what I meant by complete claims documentation was enough information that I could make a mathematical computation of the loss and determine whether it was a loss for which we were responsible.
Would the record tell us what the percentage of cases, for instance, in which complete claim supporting documents as a phrase would be used in the industry?
No. It's an understood. It's like anyone submitting an insurance claim to their insurance company. They prove the amount they want their insurance company to know with as much detail as possible what their claim is, that it's covered under the policy, and the exact amount that they ask for a check.
But all I was going to say is I don't really fully understand why it's not at a minimum a disputed issue of fact between you and your opponents as to whether this package of documents did live up to the industry practice or the language of the letter or whatever we choose to look at, because you obviously have a difference of opinion about it, so there's a dispute, and it appears to have factual dimensions to it.
Well, Judge Zagel, he recognized that there was a dispute about this, and you're quite correct, Your Honor, that he did make factual findings.
And I'm telling you that a question about the statute of limitations does not affect the subject matter jurisdiction of the court. It just doesn't. It's an affirmative defense under Rule 8C, and you can certainly raise it. Sometimes it's even raised on the pleadings if the face of the pleading shows that there's a problem. But this is a mess.
I would agree with Your Honor that that is most often the case. But under the Carriage of Goods by Sea Act, there is ample case authority holding that the one-year statutory time pursuit limitation is jurisdictional.
Well, lots of cases talk about jurisdiction, and this court is frequently in the position of saying maybe you were talking about jurisdiction, but in fact, nobody is saying that federal courts suddenly can't adjudicate whether a proper COGSA claim or any other kind of claim has been brought. So I'm skeptical that this kind of disputed issue of fact as to whether there was an extension of time or not is a subject matter jurisdiction issue.
Are you saying it's different because it's maritime law?
That's what I'm saying.
Saying
it's COGSA, yeah.
I'm saying it's different. If, for example, no extension of suit time had been requested, and they simply filed late, more than 1 year after the goods were delivered, a court would say, I mean, numerous courts have said, I'm not so sure about this court today, but numerous courts have said that this, we have no jurisdiction to entertain this lawsuit because it's brought more than 1 year after the goods were delivered, and that's Title 46 United States Code 1306.
I wanted to ask you if you thought filing suits in multiple venues as a protective measure is really a practice that we want to encourage.
Well,
I was really sort of amazed at part of that decision.
I don't think it is.
Yeah.
My time out?
Nope.
No. There is a point that I want to make about complete claims documentation, so that you can identify the claim numbers and the bills of lading. And that prevents, among other things, the kind of mischief that is ongoing right now in the Northern District of Indiana. After you see the $50,000 claim for a part of the cargo carried on the Daviken that was delivered in Michigan, they gave us the damage survey report to begin with. We didn't have to ask for it. We didn't have to ask for complete claims documentation. That claim was filed over in the Northern District of Indiana in a timely manner. But now, because this $834,000 claim has been dismissed by Judge Zagel, they have increased the addendum for the timely $50,000 claim to $884,000. And you see, that is why that this claims documentation becomes so important to prevent mischief like this, piggybacking a time-barred claim onto a timely claim. Every bill of lading is a shipment, its own shipment. And it's not legally correct to say we had a shipment of 2,000 coils of steel on 600 bills of lading. No, you had 600 shipments of steel. And so I just need to make that point. Now, they never asked for a motion to transfer, and they've cited some cases in their brief, none of which support their position. Norwegian Caribbean Line, they offered to transfer the case. It was their motion, alternative motion, to transfer. The Lou Backrot case, where the judge said, I'll give you 15 days to file a motion to transfer, of course he did, because the case wasn't time-barred. Our case was time-barred. So it would have been completely inappropriate for Judge Zagel to have resurrected a time-barred claim by giving him a motion to transfer, by suggesting a transfer.
But does your case read, do we have to find, for example, it was time-barred, or the venue issue should have resulted in transfer? If we don't find it was time-barred, could have been transferred?
If it wasn't time-barred, could it have been transferred? If it wasn't time-barred, could it have been transferred?
Should it have been transferred?
Should it have been transferred? I say no. I say no. That's a contractual term. I say it should be dismissed and refiled. And if it's refiled in time, and it's not time-barred when it's refiled in Indiana, we go ahead with the lawsuit. But this is so clear about the port of discharge being Burns Harbor, Indiana. And the cases they cite, one of the things they cite is a consent decree, which was drafted by the parties, in effect a stipulation that a bakery territory included, the Chicago area of a bakery territory included Indiana. I mean, parties to those things can stipulate to whatever they will, but it doesn't affect us. Right?
Your time's up.
My time has expired, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. How much time? You have 3 minutes, Mr. Sweeney.
Just getting back to the point that Your Honor raised. This involves a consolidation of three different cases, and certainly in two of those there was no time bar issue at all, so that transfer in the interest of justice as we've seen with numerous other district court cases, was warranted here rather than the harsh penalty of dismissal. There was no bad faith, there was no improper motive, nothing like that. The same would hold true for the larger case, the Dabikin. That should, in the interest of justice, have been transferred as well. The two cases that the district court cited, there was dismissal involved because there was a lack of personal jurisdiction in the transfer in the lower court. Here, there's been no allegation that there's anything wrong, any problems with personal jurisdiction.
Richard Sweeney, is your practice mostly maritime and admiralty law?
Yes.
Have you seen the term complete claim supporting documents in other cases?
No, Your Honor. It's something that was just inserted into this particular extension of suit time. COGSA has a very short suit time in the context of things. It's a one-year provision. And that's just getting back to what we were talking about before. It may well be easy to file a suit, but again, I don't think protective actions in alternative districts is something that we want to get into because of judicial economy and so on. However, the purpose of these extensions, most of these cases do get settled, and the purpose of the extension is to give the parties time to explore settlements because 99.99% of these cases get resolved by way of settlement without counsel's intervention. I take issue, of course, with my colleague's interpretation that the term is understood. I think it's understood, but it's understood by different people in different ways. Also, just as a jurisdictional point for this court, the question of the ambiguity, in other words, was that term ambiguous or not, was never raised on a cross appeal by FedNav, the defendants here. And consequently,
it doesn't have to be, though, if they aren't seeking broader relief than the district court gave them, and the district court gave them everything it could, right? It dismissed
claims. Yes.
So you can support a judgment on an alternative ground.
The time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.